from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Thanksgiving Day is already upon us. How can we celebrate with food for the body as well as for the soul? Father Leo Padalinhug has some ideas for us. And last week, the U.S. bishops gave thanks for 100 years of the United States Bishops' Conference during their annual meeting in Baltimore. The National Catholic Register was there to cover the assembly from on the ground. In fact, my co-host Matthew Bunsen was there in person, as he is here in person with me. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host for Register Radio. And Matthew, it's so great to have you in the studio.
It is always a treat to come down to Birmingham, if for no other reason than just to be able to be in studio with you and Jeff.
Oh, it's great.
So, I should say Jeff Burson, our redoubtable producer.
Absolutely. We don't talk enough about Jeff, and we need to bring him on the show sometime. But Matthew, you attended the bishops' meeting where they celebrated their 100th anniversary. What did they do to celebrate, and was there cake?
The cake part, I cannot confirm, but I cannot deny that either. I know there was a dinner. And they had a guest of honor, and the guest of honor is a pretty significant one, and that is Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the Vatican Secretary of State, who brought the good wishes of the Holy Father, but who also had a number of rather pointed things to say to the bishops of the United States, stressing unity, and for them to be a prophetic voice in culture today at a time that everyone recognizes is one of division and difficulty in a lot of different areas, politically, socially, and economically for the country.
Sure. Well, we'll get into some of those things that are divisive and those things that the bishops discuss. But before we get into any details, I want to invite into the conversation our other guest for the first segment here, and that is Joan Desmond, who is senior editor of the Register. Joan, great to have you on.
Nice to be here with you guys.
So Joan's going to be talking with us a little bit towards the end of this segment about the Week for Persecuted Christians. But first, we also wanted to bring her into the discussion of the Bishops' Conference, because for many years, when she lived out in the D.C. area, she covered the conference regularly and has great insights into how the Bishops' Assembly works. And so, Joan, we're glad to have you as a part of this discussion where Matthew covered on the ground. So, Matthew, what were some of the things that were discussed and just the normal course of business for this conference?
Yeah, well, they heard a number of reports, and that sounds rather dry and boring, but the reports were on some pretty significant topics, from racism to immigration to tax reform, the things that really the country is talking about and the things that the country's worried about. They also had a number of elections of chairs for different committees of the USCCB. Again, doesn't sound very interesting, but these are the bishops and cardinals who are going to be setting the tone, who will be sort of the public face of a lot of the committees that the bishops want to use to express themselves in some of the key issues of our time.
Well, of course, immigration tends to be a divisive issue. Was there much discussion about what is to be done? Was there division amongst the bishops about how what their statement should be or whatnot?
Yeah, the bishops on both racism, which is not a big surprise, but also immigration, really reached a swift consensus in dealing with the Trump administration. The conference seems pretty opposed to a number of the Trump administration's policies, in particular DACA, involving immigrant, or I should say illegal immigrant children who are making their way to the United States. So the bishops want a strong statement about that. In fact, I think we can anticipate that one's going to be forthcoming from them about that.
Okay, very interesting. Well, Joan, Matthew mentioned some of these committee chairs that were voted upon. One of them really tended to get a lot of attention before the vote, and this was the pro-life committee. You wrote a blog about it. Can you tell us a little bit what was at play here for the pro-life chair?
So the two choices were Archbishop Joseph Naumann of Kansas City and Cardinal Blaise Supich of Chicago. And, you know, Jeanette, what was so interesting, I thought Matthew really hit the point there earlier, is that there are divisions in our society, and people like to bring all those divisions into church news, whether they really understand it very well. And, of course, that's even more true often for media of a more secular variety, that isn't really fully engaged, and then they kind of rediscover church news at a pivotal moment like the bishops' conference, and then they weigh in from their own frame as to what it's all about. And in this case, I think it was a little bit more complex than how the media tried to describe it.
Basically, I'm going to butt in for a minute. You're saying basically is people use political language to talk about, and political left and right or liberal and conservative to talk about the church, and that was at play here. So what were they interpreting?
Well, and let's add something important, too, that, Joan, your blog piece, in the midst of this flurry of media discussion and speculation about the vote, was one of the very, very few grown-up, sensible approaches that I was reading, especially in Catholic media, to the vote for the pro-life committee.
Well, let's get into the blog. So what did you say?
Yeah, sorry. And by the way, thank you, Matthew. Mm-hmm. I knew I liked you a lot. But so what I want to say is it was between Archbishop Naumann, who is a longtime pro-life activist and leader. People probably recall when he called Governor Sebelius to account because of her pro-abortion views. Later on in the more recent 2016 campaign trail, he called out Senator Tim Kaine, who had presented himself as a committed Catholic but just happened to take a pro-choice position on many legislative issues. And so he's always been front and center on that. And by comparison, Cardinal Cupich has certainly weighed in on abortion issues and has taken the church's position, but pro-lifers often saw him as someone more interested in embracing a seamless garment formulation, i.e. abortion as one of many important issues. And I think pro-lifers are always concerned that abortion can get lost when that happens, and they see the U.S. bishops as national leaders at both the moral and intellectual level, really since Roe v. Wade first became the law of the land.
And, of course, this vote, Bishop Naumann won, Archbishop Naumann won this election. But, Matthew, it was not an easy win, so to speak.
Yeah, I think the vote was 96-82 with a rather surprising, 32 abstentions from the bishops. Now, there are a lot of different interpretations on what those abstentions meant, and I'll leave that to the bishops to interpret it for us. But the one thing that's notable is that this vote was then characterized in some portions of media as a kind of affront, as a deliberate insult to Pope Francis, that by not electing Cardinal Cupich to this post, this was a rejection of Pope Francis, which strikes me as, again, you hit on something important, Jeanette, and that is the use of political language to describe what the bishops are doing. And this mm-hmm. was a pretty severe insult, not just to Pope Francis and Archbishop Naumann, but to the bishops themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's really the key point here. And it's hard, it's a complicated issue, but that's really the key issue. And I think the faithful can really get confused if they're not reading more in-depth Catholic news coverage, and they think, well, gee, is my bishop dissing the Holy Father? Well, that is just not very likely the case at all. There's no evidence of that. You have one person who just has an in-depth pro-life record and another one who has a slightly different reputation for concerns about a broader range of social justice issues. And it's really just that simple, but it is an example of how these things can sort of go right off the rails, leave the bishops kind of trying to explain things to the people back in the pews.
Well, one point that Matthew makes in a piece that's running in our upcoming print edition on this conference, it's an analysis piece, Bishop Naumann was actually on the pro-life committee as well. So there, you know, he already was deeply involved in the work of this particular committee. So, yeah, the lesson is we can't look at these things from purely political terms. And really, Matthew, your piece in this upcoming edition makes the case that while there is great division in our country, the bishop's course is steady. They have a very steady course on issues of immigration and race and religious freedom. And that's one thing I wanted to bring up, Joan, with you. We have about 5 minutes or so. And there was another election that happened, a chair for the Religious Liberty Committee. And Archbishop Lurie has been the chair of that committee since 2011 when it was first established, and he was finally rolling off, and he needed a successor. So who was elected, Joan? And then also, what pressing religious liberty issue is on our plate now?
Yeah, well, first, let's give a shout-out for Archbishop Lurie. Really a remarkable job, and you may recall it started off very slow. A lot of people were adamantly opposed. They thought the bishops had overreacted to the HHS mandate. And then, as we've seen, a whole range of issues have come up over these last couple of years, and religious freedom is now front and center as a very significant issue in our society. So Archbishop Joseph Kurtz, who is a former U.S. CCB president, won the election, and I think that's a vote of confidence for him. He has been a very strong voice on religious freedom, and I think will continue the direction set by Archbishop Lurie. But, you know, other issues have come up, too, as you mentioned, and moving beyond the domestic policy concerns of the bishops, we also have international religious freedom concerns, i.e. the persecution of Christians in the Middle East, and specifically. And there's been some good news on that. Our reporter Peter Smith covered the game changer on that when Vice President Pence promised to a group of activists that going into the future, maybe starting in February or March, that U.S. funds would now be more focused on USAID and would actually get to church groups on the ground, like Aid to the Church in Need, CRS, and others, to bring aid more quickly and more transparently to Christians. So there's been over $1 billion in aid directed for the rehabilitation of Iraq, including aid going to Christian communities. And but basically, on the ground, this aid is not reaching Christians. And the UN has been the primary conduit for this aid. And basically, people have started to criticize the UN, saying that they are not getting aid to Christians for a variety of reasons. It's not happening, and they have looked for other ways to bring that aid. And so Pence's announcement was a big breakthrough, because it means that trusted organizations that have a greater level of transparency and are close to Christians right on the ground will now be directly bringing that aid in many cases.
Well, the other reason that we're talking about aid to persecuted Christians is that the USCCB and the Knights of Columbus, who have been very, very involved in getting aid to the persecuted Christians, have announced just recently a week dedicated to the awareness and prayer for persecuted Christians. That week begins November 26th, and there will be a mass for persecuted Christians that will be on November 28th. It'll be airing on EWTN, and as well as on November 26th, a holy hour for persecuted Christians on EWTN. And there's a site, actually a page, excuse me, on the USCCB that offers a prayer for persecuted Christians. So I really invite our audience to pray in a special way, basically the week after Thanksgiving, for persecuted Christians, that we might be in solidarity with them, and in a practical way too, that they end up getting the aid that they need, because we really do risk losing Christians in the place where Christianity was born, and that would truly be tragic. So, Matthew, Joan, it's been great to have you on. Matthew, you in the studio, and Joan joining us by phone. I appreciate both of your wisdom in the work that we do.
Thanks so much, Jeanette and Matthew.
When we come back, we'll be joined by Father Leo Padalinhug to help us prepare for Thanksgiving and Advent. This is Register Radio on EWTN. More when we return.
Father Wade Menezes talks about the National Catholic Register.
As the National Catholic Register celebrates its 90th anniversary, I think that says a lot about the publication. It works. It's solidly Catholic. It presents the teachings of the church unabashedly so, and also guides its readers to be even more solidly Catholic themselves. One of the major effects that I think the Register has on its readers is that it elevates the intellect. Whether it be a faith item or a news item, it presents the news and the faith item in a very balanced way. One thing that the Register can never be accused of is being too far left or too far right. It is solidly Catholic, right in line with the Chair of Peter, and I think that says a lot about the Register.
For a 6-issue free trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner, or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy some of our online content.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Next week is Thanksgiving, and cutting through the busyness of preparations, Father Leo Padalinghug reminds us of how to make sure our time at the table is about more than physical nourishment, but about our spiritual nourishment, too.
Let's start with your background. Where are you from?
Okay, originally from the Philippines, came to America when I was about 2 years old. Baltimore has always been home and lived there, except for the times when I lived in Italy, in the Vatican, studying as a seminarian, where there, while I knew how to cook, I kind of honed in on some skills, and there, during seminary, developed a theology of food, which led to the Grace Before Meals movement.
How influential was that, your background, your Filipino background?
So interesting. The Filipinos were still a pretty poor country. You know, I mean, there's some beautiful parts to it, so it's not a negative thing to say that they live a very simple life. But the one thing that everybody knows about them is that they are like masters of hospitality. They love parties and fiestas, and they're all centered around the faith. So it is very much a part of who I am and what I do.
And as part of a Filipino family, have you been able to go to the Philippines and trace your background?
Absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, we filmed 3 of my episodes of Savoring Our Faith, which shows up at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN, and 3 of those episodes were filmed in the Philippines. And so it was great to be able to reconnect with, you know, the culture, the food, and the faith, and the people.
People know you probably best as, I don't want to say foodie priest, but they certainly know you, your connection to food. But talk about your vocation to the priesthood, because that can be overlooked.
Oh, well, it shouldn't be overlooked. And as a matter of fact, you know, my social media handle is Father Leo Feeds, and the movement is Grace Before Meals. And it just shows how, as a priest, we can't be limited to just experiencing us on Sundays for an hour. Most of our real, authentic experiences of ministry happen at the dinner table in families' homes, when we're at the bedside of someone, giving them viaticum, which is the last meal to receive, and try to give them consolation at a funeral. And then, of course, we can't avoid water of baptism, and then the oil of confirmation. Food is inextricably connected to our priesthood.
Food, though, obviously has become something in culture of almost an obsession with a lot of people. The very term foodie, the idea that you are willing to travel long distances just to consume a meal in a restaurant.
Yeah.
What are the lessons there for people?
Well, I think it's kind of weird. If food is just now like a hobby and something for you to conquer, then you're missing the point of it. The food itself is only the way, the means to the end. And the end is communion. To be able to come around a dinner table and to be with people. Food is not to be eaten alone. And when people just do that, it's kind of an unhealthy reality. They can become, as you said, an obsession. But for me, the whole Grace Before Meals movement is about showing not how to cook a meal, but why to cook a meal. And that is to feed people, which is, if you take it seriously, the first of the precepts that Jesus said. You know, if you want to get to heaven, did you feed my sheep?
Very simple.
It can't be difficult. And I think that's what people do. They want to make the food the object, the objective of it all. And it's interesting that Jesus becomes that, but he shows us that the real object is heaven. So I'm trying to cook and kind of leave delicious food along the path to heaven.
One of the things that is often cited in the breakdown of the family, in a way to your point, is the fact that families today so rarely eat together, and extended families eat together even more rarely.
It's a sin to miss Mass. and therefore we break the commandment if we are not there for that meal. And it also hurts, I think, our family members when we're not there for that meal. And so I don't mind a little Catholic guilt. My mom calls me sometimes and says, aren't you the priest on TV who talks about family meals? Where are you, you know? So I just know that food and mealtimes is what makes us uniquely human. We're the only creatures in God's kingdom that actually cooks. We're the only creatures because we have a rational soul. And if this idea of cooking is to give us sustenance, then we have to know that it's the responsibility of the parents to provide for their children. And that's why, you know, the whole Grace Before Meals movement is trying to bring families back around the dinner table. And it sounds simple, but try put it into practice with meaning, and you'll see just how difficult it is.
And in an era of everyone on their cell phones, everyone somewhere else, or even when people are gathered together, their attention seems to be somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that people don't know how to have conversations anymore, and I believe that eating a great meal is the perfect vehicle for conversation because, frankly, if the food is good, you can't talk with your mouth full, so you got to listen. And this idea of conversion is it comes from conversation. And so where do you learn how to have conversation? Well, at the dinner table. I remember that very clearly from my mom and dad. You know, learn how to say please, how to say thank you, and more importantly, how to be a servant.
And the idea, too, of cooking for someone as preparing a meal as a gesture of love.
Yeah, this is what made Mother Teresa a saint. Mother Teresa of Calcutta, she fed everyone and anyone, and she said that she was a pencil in God's hand. Really, I think she was more of a frying pan because the woman, all she did was feed people because that is the first sign of love. And I know that biologically because that is what moms do with an unborn child, feeds that baby. And that's exactly what God, the providential Father, wanted to do for us. There's a whole theology out there, and I kind of catalog it in my book, Epic Food Fight. So I've got three books. One is on family meals, one is on couples, and one is on sacramentality of food, and talk about a theology of food. God wants to feed us.
And for the average person who's saying, okay, so we're supposed to have meals together, I have no idea how to cook.
Well, learn is what I say. And there are so many books out there. And I know that for some people, it is hard work. It's not even fun for them. And to them, I say, guess what? Welcome to life. It is called a liturgy. And the word in Greek, which we use to describe Mass, it's actually the word in Greek that means work. So you got to find out for yourself, what are you working for? And if it's just working to like fill your pockets with money, then that's just foolish because you can't take everything with you. You can only take the kind of relationships you have with you, and they are qualitatively discerned at a family meal. So work, liturgy, feed your kids.
And in that feeding, it's surprising to a lot of parents that they themselves are suddenly fed.
Oh, well, my goodness gracious, they will learn just how much of a blessing it is when their children invite them to dinner. And that's the real beauty. I'm writing my fourth book now called Saving Your Family. And the whole premise is to encourage parents to be formation directors. And in a sense, they become supper heroes. They become what our world is hungering for. And they will know that their job is done when their kids cook for them and feed them. And, you know, you think about it, that's exactly what has to happen. When they get older, who's going to feed them? Are you going to just leave it to some institution that doesn't care? Or are you going to let your family feed you in thanksgiving for all the ways you have fed them?
You travel a lot.
Too much.
Well, you travel a lot for your different programs. And now remind me, how many shows?
This is about six or seven. I can't tell you anymore because it just – they all run together. But the first three seasons were all in kitchen segments. And then the
– And for anyone who hasn't seen it, the name of the show.
Savoring Our Faith every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN. And the new shows are traveling shows, and we try to feed people body, mind, and soul. And so we go to a church where our soul is fed – a restaurant where our body is fed, and then I go into a kitchen with local guests, and I kind of create a menu to feed the mind and help us remember those visits. And it's been amazing to see where the church is. We're not just locked up in a church building. We're everywhere. And good Catholics, as good restaurateurs, they're feeding hungry souls too.
Well, I was going to ask that in your experience of travel, both here in the United States, but of course around the world, what are some of the things that really strike you the most about families and restaurants and food together?
Yeah, there is one common denominator for me that I've discovered. The closer the family around the table, the stronger the family is. And the better the food, the better the relationship. So please, families, don't cook leftovers all the time. Be exciting. Be willing to venture out. But at the same time, keep holding on to your traditions. And those are things that can happen at a family meal. And so stronger families is better food.
And do you find, too, with your travel that much as we see with social media, with clothing, with communications in general, that there's a kind of withering away of what makes some of these cultures so unique and so special?
I think we have lost a lot in our culture because we've bought into the fast food mentality. And I have no trouble with fast food. I find value in them. And I eat it sometimes because I'm always on the road. But the mentality is that I'm too busy to cook for you, to feed you, and I'm too busy to spend time with you. So if you families are just too busy that you can't eat with your family regularly, then you're too busy doing useless things. You have one responsibility, to be a family. And where can that happen? Well, take a note from God, around the dinner table.
So Father Leo's thoughts are also a part of our Advent preparations, as the Register has gotten a column from him on Advent. The column is a fun mixture of talking about, you know, how not to be Scrooge, but he also ends with a special little gift.
And that would be a recipe for all of our readers and our listeners, how to make it. It's a Christmas cookie, basically. So while we remember that Advent is a penitential time, Father Leo was also giving us that added gift as one of the church's great sort of chef priests.
Absolutely. I kind of look forward to making them with my son. He's been very into baking lately, so we'll have some fun with Father Leo's cookies. So, Father Leo, thank you for that. His column, A Cheerful Giver is Also a Cheerful Receiver, is in the November 26th edition and also online with our other news and commentary at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello.